Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 87th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have today with me James Walden. Hello, James.
Hello, Gary.
James Walden is an associate professor of computer science at Northern Kentucky University, just across the river from Cincinnati. Dr. Walden's research focuses on software security with special concentration on web applications and mobile applications. He also studies metrics. Before becoming a professor, James worked as a senior software engineer at Intel. He spent a year at the Catholic University Leuven in Belgium in 2011. Dr. Walden has a PhD in physics from CMU and a BS in physics from Miami University. He lives somewhere secret in Kentucky with a cat named Laptop. So how do you find yourself slumming it in a science with science in its name after studying physics?
So I see that you do know something about physicists, as it is a common story among physicists, is that a field has science in the name, it's not one.
Exactly.
Well, I did particle physics for my PhD, and while the experimentalists have done great work at particle accelerators verifying the standard model of particle physics, really as far as theory goes, we haven't done so well. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the standard model, which was finished when I was in kindergarten, has been right for my entire lifetime.
Weren't you supposed to fix that, James?
Well, I tried a career as an ambulance-chasing physicist where every time a particle accelerator would say, oh, this measurement's 4 standard deviations off, and we would rush out to write a paper to explain that.
Right.
And then the experimentalist would come back and say, no, that was a measurement error. Actually, the standard model's right after all.
Right. That's pretty funny.
So I decided computer science had more room to learn new stuff.
Yeah, so when did you sort of officially make that transition? I'm sure you were coding probably in CTRAN or something like that, which is the physicist version of Fortran.
I did do the Fortran.
Yeah.
I've been programming actually since late elementary school when I got an Apple II Plus in, I think, 1979.
Yeah, me too, although I got mine in 1981, so I don't think you got a II Plus in 79.
Because they didn't exist. That was out then?
They didn't exist yet. Mine still works. I still got it in my attic.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah. I'll show it to you next time you come over to the house. So let's talk about software security. You've been very active in software security for years, both academically and helping with top 10 lists and talking to corporations and so on. Do you think we're making progress in the field?
I think we are. Not as much as we would hope, but developers do have an awareness that software security exists, which is a step forward. And they usually know how to deal with a number of the common vulnerabilities. They're very aware of things like SQL injection and cross-site scripting. On the other hand, an actual secure software engineering lifecycle is pretty limited to the larger companies, especially in the financial industry.
Right. I think that's right, but we've seen a pretty huge upswell in demand from corporations, even outside of financial services, for software security people. For example, we have 20 openings right now at Cigital, and we grew 25% last year, so we're growing as fast as we can find good people. Is the existence of this demand getting through to students? Like, do people that are coming to NKU, or are they saying, wow, software security seems really hot, I got to figure out how to get on board?
Unfortunately, I don't think it is.
So what do we do to fix that?
That's a good question. Certainly, we as faculty can tell them, but I'm usually teaching software security. I do have a senior-level class, but my actual secure software engineering course is at the master's level.
Mm-hmm.
And we're largely getting people who have worked in the field for not a long time, 3 to 5 years on average, coming back. And a lot of them seem interested in it, but the employers certainly aren't really mentioning it at the undergrad level, at least not to our university.
We got to fix that. We'll take all the ones you can produce. And I know you've used my book in the past too, so that's a double whammy. So they'll even know some of the nomenclature that we use around here.
That they will. Yeah, I'm still using that in our secure software engineering class.
Cool. So let's talk about the NASCAR effect. You know, the sexiness of breaking stuff. You can use that as a way to attract students. Have you tried that?
That's something we actually are discussing adding to our curriculum, is a course really focused on breaking things. Mm-hmm. We certainly do demos of breaking things, and yes, those always do attract students. That's also, I guess, one of the things that helped me first get into security was trying to break the copy protection on Apple II games.
Me too, man. Back in the day with Greg Morissette, who's now, I think he's a dean or the chair at Harvard or something. We found out that breaking the games turned out to be more fun than actually playing the games once we broke them.
It often was. It was quite a puzzle quest to find out all the layers of encryption that they used.
So you've been involved with both OWASP and SANS, I think, helping with their top N list, top 10 or top 25. Why is there no list of top 10 flaws? And why do you think we have such a myopic focus on bugs?
I think bugs are easier to understand and explain, and they are more directly connected to common types of exploits. Mm-hmm. So I think basically we focus on bugs because they're low-hanging fruit.
There you go. So can you give us an example of a flaw so everybody knows what we're talking about?
So a flaw is a design problem, which could be as simple as not actually checking for authentication or access control in a web application, which is a sadly common mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in some sense, if you don't authenticate the user, it's an error of omission, so it's not going to be in the code, and so on. So code review wouldn't help you find that. So let's talk about teaching. The problem with something like architecture risk analysis or threat modeling and so on is figuring out how to teach it. So do you try to teach ways to find flaws in class, and how do you do that pedagogically?
We do try that. In my secure software engineering class, I focus on using existing open source code instead of having students develop an application of their own, because there's just not enough time to develop an application and have the time to go through enough history to explore its security evolution. And so we do have students do a risk analysis based on certain open source applications. But yes, I guess it's not something like parsing where there's a nice formality and everything is well defined and such. So we start them with, we actually start at the end of the development life cycle. I start with testing, go on to code review.
Got it.
And then once they have experience with vulnerabilities at that level, we move on to architectural risk analysis.
Yeah, so you kind of move to the left. That's a natural progression that the field is actually demonstrating as it unfolds out there in the world. So code review is pretty easy to teach, right? You get a tool. There are some open source tools. There's some commercial tools that let academics use them. And you show them bugs, right, and teach them how to fix them, presumably?
Right.
So do you spend a lot of time talking about fixing the problems that they find? Because we're finding that's a problem in the commercial world. There are a lot of people that are very busy piling up bugs in big piles, and they don't know anything about fixing them.
We do spend time in fixing them.
Cool.
And I use one of my favorite books, actually, that addresses both the issue of flaws and fixing them better than any other, which is Chess and West. Secure Programming with Static Analysis.
Yep, that's a great book. It's part of the software security series that I edit.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about the book is that it when it discusses, for example, buffer overflows, it doesn't just say, well, use strlen and check the length and just do this everywhere and you'll be fine, mm-hmm. which obviously you won't be, given our history with buffer overflows. it goes and explains various memory allocation strategies that different applications use, like mm-hmm. Apache has its memory pools and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it talks about how to fix this at the design level as well as at the individual coding bug level.
Oh, that's really good. I mean, we see that all the time. So, for example, if you're thinking about cross-site scripting, you might find 1,200 instances, but actually there's one design problem that underlies them all, right?
Right.
So I think that hopefully that insight's going to trickle into the field a little bit more than it has so far. What about pen testing? I mean, you said you start right. Do you start, with security testing and pen testing all the way with a black box app?
I do mostly a gray box pen test. They do have access to the source code, but they usually don't have a lot of time to read it for these activities. So it's basically there to sort of help them go back mm-hmm. and verify mm-hmm. that, okay, found this, it looks like a bug, where's it coming from in the code? But we do some security testing where they have a testing plan to look for specific vulnerabilities as well.
Right, so both kinds of testing, that's cool. So we got pen testing, we got security testing, we got code review, we have ARA a little bit. Any work on requirements for security, or is that just too bureaucratic?
I've done a little work with misuse cases and such, but I'm still on the fence about how useful they are. We don't do a lot of work on that, especially as it's very difficult to get requirements for real open source apps. They don't usually start with them.
Exactly. Hippie code doesn't have requirements.
Right.
So, let's get back to actually fixing code. So it's great that you're teaching students how to do that, and I agree that the Chess and West book is quite good at that stuff. Are there people that are working on automating the fixing process somewhat? I mean, years ago we did some work on aspect-oriented programming. I see that you have a recent publication on that stuff. You want to describe how that works or doesn't work, as the case may be?
I worked with a student, Bojan Simic, on his master's thesis on using aspect to essentially prevent security vulnerabilities. And we looked at both SQL injection and cross-site scripting.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually used the Fortify static analysis tool to identify the problems. And then our tool would look at the vulnerability reports, look at how they're classified as a type of vulnerability, and then it would automatically weave in an aspect mm-hmm. to either do input validation or some additional checks like tautology checking for SQL injection.
Did you ever see aspects that stomped on each other? Because in our early work for DARPA, gosh, it must have been 10 years ago, we had a few weavers, and the weavers would occasionally collide with each other.
No, actually, we didn't encounter that problem.
Good. Maybe they were easier bugs.
Yeah, we did set the system to basically fail through to, if something went wrong, there was an exception that we didn't know how to handle, it would go through the old insecure path, so we wouldn't break the application.
Right, yeah.
We applied it to some pretty large applications, too, like Eclipse.
Cool. And it actually worked in practice.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, so you probably don't know this, but Gregor Gonzalez, the guy who invented aspect-oriented programming, is my stepbrother-in-law.
Oh, I didn't.
The planet's really small. 1 year, a million years ago, we were both giving dueling keynotes at Software Development West. He was the Tuesday guy, and I was the Wednesday guy. Let's talk a little bit more about pen testing. One of the things that I've said, which my people get all over me about, even though it's true, is that pen testing is sort of becoming a commodity. And I always say, if you want to have a career where you get paid less every year, you should become a pen tester. Do you see any evidence of that in academia, or does everybody think pen testing is so cool, by gosh, that's what you got to do in the future?
I think we see the same thing that you're seeing, more more and more people are learning how to do it, and so the cost of pen testing is going down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not surprising. A lot of the things that are done in pen testing aren't very high skill, although certainly there are people out there who are highly skilled and can do some pretty amazing things.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, I guess, the most cursory kind of pen testing that's commodifying. And
right,
commodifying
yeah.
fast. I mean, we've seen prices drop probably 50% for what people are willing to pay for that stuff. And that for good reason, too. I mean, you know, pen tests often don't give you enough information to fix the stuff. It's much better the farther left you move in the life cycle, the more information you have to fix the system.
Right. That's one of the big reasons I prefer code reviews to pen tests.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, I tell students that pen tests are a good way to get attention from management, that you do have a problem and maybe you should go and code review all of your applications.
So I just heard laptop trying to get some attention from management.
Yes, he's very good at that. I think because I'm on the phone and he doesn't see anyone I'm talking to, he's decided that I clearly must be talking to him.
So he's just answering the questions. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. Let's switch gears. So in light of the NSA surveillance stuff and the promulgation of Facebook among the kids that you teach every day, what do you think? Do we have any type of privacy, any hope for privacy in this country?
I think privacy, yes, unfortunately, continuing to diminish. And as new generations are accustomed to a society with less privacy, we're on sort of a downward slope, whereas they don't demand more privacy, and therefore both companies and government take advantage of the data they collect, and so we have less and less privacy mm-hmm. as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. Do you try to teach that when you're talking about design at all?
It is something I do bring up, but it's something we do tend to cover more in other classes, like our computer security class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you know, privacy. I'm not sure how you pedagogically approach privacy. Sort of like teaching philosophy. Although I do have a degree in that, I can't remember how they taught me stuff.
Yeah, it's a hard issue because you do have to teach them the value of it, and so you have to get rid of certain myths in our culture, like I have nothing to hide, so why should I care that I'm watched 24/7?
Right. Turns out you do have stuff to hide, or stuff you'd rather keep private. You know, Avi did an exercise once at Johns Hopkins that was pretty cool. He sort of set the kids to go use public records to out each other, a target of their choice. And it was amazing what the kids were able to find out just, through public databases and all sorts of other things like that.
Yeah, we do a Google hacking exercise in our computers security class where they do a bit of that. And yeah, it is really amazing what you can find out when you can tie together multiple public information sources.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that sort of activity is precisely what the NSA was doing and continues to do. So there's a lot more information about you every day. You make a huge digital trail than most people realize, I guess. And I think that part of software security ought to be teaching about thinking through the implications of what your system is doing. And how it could be abused that way. So maybe you could turn abuse cases towards the service of privacy, maybe.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting idea. I mean, we do already look at information leaks where trying to teach students, don't actually, log people's passwords when they fail to log in mm-hmm. and such. And yeah, that would have a natural extension to privacy.
Okay, let's switch gears again. So let's talk about metrics and measurement, because I know metrics is another one of your research interests. I'm gonna give you two things to talk about. One is the BSIM, and it's BSIM versus badnessometers. Go.
Let's see. I love badnessometers. No, not really.
They're cheap.
They are cheap, and they are a good way of getting attention. But yeah, certainly after that, you really need to, you know, instead of just having a metric that you have 10 vulnerabilities, hey, pay attention to security. You need to move on and see, okay, you've got, you know, thousands of internal apps. What do you do with them?
Right.
And, you know, which ones do you address first? And there's a variety of metrics you can look at there. You can fairly quickly scan them with a static analysis tool and look where you either have the most problems or the most problems of a vulnerability type you're concerned with.
That's sort of a geeky technical way to approach it. Another way to approach it is by the importance of what the application does and touches in terms of assets.
Right. Yeah. That's definitely, certainly, at least as important to look at the assets, the information's protect. A lot of places do an internal versus external cut as well.
Yep, they do.
Which I have some doubts about, given how easy it is for attackers to attack internal applications these days.
That's exactly right. So everybody forgets when they talk about insiders that that's the whole purpose of most hacking, is to become an insider and then go from there.
Right. You just have to have one employee open a PDF and voila, the attacker is inside.
Right. So I really wanted to push on this notion of, you know, badnessometer is sort of a direct measurement, so to speak, of the software product or some software artifacts, as the case may be, and the BSIM as a second-order measurement, which in some sense is less satisfying, but it's also way broader. And I wonder what you think about that tension.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it is really nice to have a simple metric that management can understand. On the other hand, I have found... what I use the BSIM for in teaching and talking with corporations is a lot of them really have no idea where to start their software security program.
So if they don't have one, the BSIM is not very useful.
Well, actually, I mean, if they don't have one, but they've been convinced by their badnessometer that they want to have one, I think it's pretty useful, because it says, okay, you know, you can start here, and you can, you know, just do this very basic step that's really doable. There's not this giant mountain where you have to have, you know, a perfect metric gathering process for your code review system. You can start fairly simply and expand and refine your program as time goes on.
I think that's right. And so the purpose of the BSIM really is not a methodology, it's a measurement stick. And measurement sticks are just useful for science, right? Then you can see whether you're going forward, backward, sideways, up or down.
Right.
How many flavors did you guys have in particle physics again? So something like 24?
Well, there's six flavors of quark.
So we got forwards, backwards, upside down, left, right, charmed. What else we got?
Charmed, bottom and top. So, not the most original or exciting name, except for charm and strange.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I think we should try to categorize security defects along the same dimensions.
We can come up with our own interesting names.
That's right. One last thing I wanted to talk about. So we sort of talked about metrics, but time is running short. What impact do you think Ruby and other modern languages might have on software security? And are you seeing that leak into the curriculum? Are you getting demand for that sort of stuff from the kids?
We do teach Ruby, actually, although in our IT program rather than our CS program. Yeah, modern languages, of course, you know, have a lot of advantages. Just the moment you get memory management handled by the language, life becomes a lot easier without buffer overflows.
Right, so we already had that advantage in Java and C#.
Right, and Ruby does have a nice taint feature where it tracks the flow of input. And if you enable this feature, essentially you have to have input validation for all potentially dangerous input. And I like that security feature a lot. I'd like to see that in other languages or introduced through frameworks.
Do you think that the designers of those languages are even cognizant of that, or was it accidental that they made the taint stuff?
I think that they were cognizant of that because Ruby was so highly used in the web space,
right,
where there were so many attacks at that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I guess on the other side, if languages, unfortunately, both Java and Ruby are becoming more complex with times. And in some of my research, I have found that complexity metrics do correlate with a higher number of vulnerabilities. And of course, complexity is a fairly, well, complex topic in itself and how you measure it. And so
yeah,
we looked at McCabe's cyclomatic complexity and a nesting complexity metric.
That's just loops in your control flow diagram, I suppose.
Right. And most recently, I've been looking at a text mining approach to predicting vulnerabilities. And I found some interesting things in which features, and the features are just the keywords of the language, also including comments and variable names. But one of the things that came out on top of basically every application we've looked at is that features related to error handling, exception keyword, try, and so forth, were correlated with more vulnerabilities in every application we looked at.
Well, you remember back in the old days when we were basic programmers, when people said, oh, GoTo, watch out for that. That's pretty scary stuff. Don't use GoTo.
Right.
Guess what exception handling is?
Yes. Basically, yes, it's a slightly controlled GoTo. Although, in some ways, a little worse.
That's right. It's a branching GoTo.
Right. Yeah, you never know at what level the exception's going to be caught at, other people edit your code, and then they usually don't have a track of, you know, what potentially security-relevant resources they should be disposing of properly.
Right, 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 right. So there you have it. You know, software security turns out to be hard.
Unfortunately, or, well, fortunately for continued employment, yes.
Make us more kids, will you? We need them.
I'll do my best.
Say one other question. So last week, I guess, we had Daft Punk come out, and we had Cat Power new stuff come out, and The National put some stuff out. What are you listening to these days?
Actually, let's see. I've been listening to Dream Theater, but not a terribly recent album.
There's new music, really. There is, honest.
There is? Okay.
Go check it out. You're hanging out with the 20-year-olds. They should be giving you a direct feed. Cool. Well, thanks. Really appreciate your time, James.
Okay. Well, it's good talking to you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. Ironically, the May-June issue of IEEE S&P features a special coverage of privacy and online social networks. It's edited by Susan Landau. Timely? I do believe it's timely. The issue also features our chat with anti-cyberwar scholar Thomas Ridd. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.